Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. I'm your host, Sucheta Kamath, and these conversations are about executive function, autonomy, independence, how do we become the most, come into ourselves and become the most productive, maybe and lead fulfilling lives. That seems to be the most important part of these conversations. And one thing, as I have shared with you guys, that it's really important to me that we broaden our lens when we think about executive function, that the field is new and it needs to be informed by many other important works that are done in other fields, because humans are not machines, and we are not brains that need to be optimized, but we also need to think about culture, history, also need to think about how the society plays a role. So today we are going to have a very interesting conversation. I wanted to kind of start off by a little interesting podcast. A girlfriend and I were on a trip. It was actually a dyslexia conference, and we both decided to listen to one podcast episode of Invisibilia. And in that particular podcast, there was a conversation that was about psychologist Roger Hart, who actually had just graduated from college, and he went to Vermont along with his friend John Marshall, and he stumbled upon this idea. John Marshall had a camera, and Roger Hart had an interest in children and their free play. So he tracked them, followed them, and he captured this amazing, beautiful video of free play. So these children were roaming far away from their homes by themselves. They would get on their bikes. They would be gone for 4 or 5 hours. Parents wouldn't know where they are. And they would just explore the world. And Roger Hart went back after 30 years, and he was absolutely astounded, because what he found, that if you can imagine the radius of the circle within which children played, had significantly shrunk. That means those children who had received complete freedom to roam around had completely, when they became parents themselves, their children were at the most exploring the backyard, which was fenced off. So this change happened. This, again, sounds very tiny, but I want to kind of bring up some other issues, such as we don't have recess anymore. We have, suburban moms hauling their children in the car for activities. That means the most time child spends is with an adult, one adult in a car, and every single thing is in a structured activity. And how does that really influence not just growth, development, but psychology, but also culture and society? And who can speak on that other than expert anthropologist? So today we are very, very lucky to have an incredible guest whose praises can be sung all day long. But it's a great honor and pleasure to introduce Dr. David Lancey. He has done extensive cross-cultural field work with children as the focus. His important work, just published in a third edition, is The Anthropology of Childhood. Now, I will tell you, you must brace yourselves when you read this book, because you're going to reread the chapter a couple of times, and you're going to be very surprised and annoyed with in what ways you are not experiencing that kind of freedom that some of the cultures are permitting for their children. And I, as a mother, felt that very strongly. That scholarly book was paired by a popular version in 2017 entitled Raising Children, Surprising Insights from Other Cultures. In total, Dr. Lancey has authored 9 books and edited 3. A new work on pedagogy in culture is something that he's working on, which I cannot wait to hear more about. And lastly, he has also authored over 80 articles and books and chapters. If I can share one thing, he began his journey as a psychologist. So I think I see a little bit of trace of psychology as it informs anthropology. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Lancey. How are you?
Thank you very much, Suchita. I'm fine. I look forward to our conversation.
Yes, I am too. So as I kicked off with this question about, the freedom children receive. So as an anthropologist, you study culture. And as an executive function specialist and a speech language pathologist, I'm interested in how children take responsibility for their lives and get ready to become competent adults. So can you first maybe begin and talk about the importance of culture in human life?
That's a very, very broad question.
Well, maybe there are differences, right? Not every culture is identical. Maybe you can share a little bit about that.
Right. I think the most people don't really – culture has many, many different meanings. So first thing, I'd have to stake a claim personally to a view of culture that's related to evolution. That is – we have human evolution, and one of our most important, as a species, humans, one of our most important assets, if you will, one of our most important characteristics of our species, we have culture. We have something called culture. And although some have argued that chimpanzees, for example, show evidence of culture, really it's not comparable. So by culture, we mean that there's this infrastructure that humans build over time. It evolves, it changes, meeting changed circumstances. But it's an infrastructure that, if you could think about it as sort of like a monument building higher and higher and higher as new ideas are introduced to the society or discovered. And then passed on through children. And that's the role that children typically play. An important role that children play is they're culture bearers. They absorb the culture, they learn the culture, and then carry it on to the next generation. And so culture is used in that way. It's like a toolkit. That's another metaphor we might use. It has all this useful information, skills, tools, building techniques, hunting techniques, all of this saves us the problem of learning anew with each generation.
So it's so interesting you say that. And I think you have written this somewhere in one of your writings, that socialization of children to become competent culture users and bearers. So I would love to maybe hang on that idea a little bit longer, because, as you think about, every place there's culture is this invisible expectations or invisible way rules of operation that we imbibe by being in the company of others. And this is what kind of, to me, at the heart of self-regulation. That means if there are, three donuts and there are seven people, I will think twice before I take the whole donut, right? So this idea that there's a culture that's dictating how I will choose to act. And if I show obliviousness to that, then I'm definitely going to be considered as a not collaborative or cooperative. And so in that way, it's such an important thing. And I do think that particularly from Western lens where I am now, I see that there's a lot of individuality. That means given importance to individual choices and everybody having a right to decide for self. And you come first. And I think maybe can you share a little bit about your experience and your understanding of that socialization to become competent culture users?
One of the things that took me a while to finally figure out as I was studying the work of other anthropologists over the years was to really appreciate that the wide gulf there is between, when we speak about cultural transmission and cultural acquisition, Cultural transmission, it turns out there's two schools of thought, two ways of looking at childhood. And one way is to see the child as very eager to learn, very aggressive in copying others' behavior, pitching in to help out in order to be a full-fledged participant in the culture. So this is culture acquisition, where the driving engine, if you will, of the whole process is within the child. It's the child's initiative, the child's first steps. And that's what we see in most indigenous societies. On the other hand, cultural transmission implies some third party, some a parent, someone else who takes the initiative to teach the child the culture. Okay, so that's a big battleground right now in my field, between those who see the primary moving force, as I said, the children's growing eagerness to learn and to be competent and to be accepted socially because of their competence, versus those who see the child largely as an empty vessel and as a, you know, stationary being that needs to be turned on and guided and shaped. So that to me is kind of an interesting, that's how, you know, I see a lot of these discussions, your introduction, in fact, a lot of this seems to revolve around freedom given to children to figure things out on their own versus closely managing their lives on the basis that they can't possibly learn anything important if they're not taught by a someone with superior knowledge. Likewise, the notion of harm to the child, risk-taking, and so on, all of those ideas neatly match up, if you will, so that in the indigenous society, there's much less concern about harm for the child. They accept that there's going to be risk involved in children's learning independently because they're free to learn. They're free to move around the village, go foraging in the forest. They have a lot of freedom because they've got to learn all this on their own. And when outsiders sort of probe or try to get parents to think more about being more hands-on, playing with their children, for example, the parents push back and say, "I don't have time for that. I'm too busy. Child will learn on its own. It doesn't need me to teach it. If it listens, if it observes, it pays attention, places itself in the right position, has the right attitude, the child will learn. No intervention needed on the part of the parent."
Well, David, this just is blowing my mind because in Western world, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the acronym WEIRD societies, because this will consider negligence and you know, neglect and abuse if you leave a 2.5-year-old to explore the world. I mean, you know, there's a whole industry that calls creating a child safe house. You know that, right?
Oh my gosh, yes, yes. The monitors, and sure, absolutely.
Yeah, or even creating locks or special bottles for pills.
Yes, 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 yes. I know all about it.
So what is the harm in that? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is a personal, one of my pet peeves is that childproof packaging turns out to be senior proof as well. And I get so annoyed when they give me my medicine, you know, my prescriptions that are in packaging that it's very difficult an older person to open.
It was so funny. Yesterday I was at a cooking class with a bunch of people and the chef, I mean, it was in a cook's warehouse. So it was, where you could buy cooking supplies. And they showed a very interesting pepper, salt and pepper, whatever, whatchamacallit. And yeah, and they have had one where because for people with arthritis, they can't turn.
They had a very interesting,
and I'm like, oh my God, instead of improving your abilities, now we have to keep adapting and creating more tools to buy it, which was $21, by the way.
Maybe I can wait a while on that purchase.
Exactly. So yeah, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about so when you talk about your indigenous experience, can you give us some examples of how the mothers leave a child to do? What kind of things are the kids doing in that environment, in the indigenous environments?
One scenario that comes to mind immediately, this occurred when I was in southwestern Madagascar, and I ran across a butchering party that had captured a large sea turtle. And this was their subsistence. So fish, marine life of various kinds. It was a community right on the ocean. And, the animal had been killed and was now being butchered. And it was a very, very large turtle, something like 4 feet in diameter, 3.5, 4 feet in diameter.
And, oh, wow.
Ringed around the turtle, which was on its back, on its carapace, were about 4 or 5 individuals. And they ranged from tiny little kid, about 3 years old, to teenagers. And the teenagers were in charge. But the little kids were free to handle the knife and to plunge their hands into the bloody guts of the animal and just having a grand time. Just wonderful, wonderful. And yes, if you tell that story or just do a little, had I filmed it, this is before the days of iPhones and easy filming, had I filmed it and showed it to modern American parents, otherwise naive, not having been to Madagascar, they would be appalled. They would be absolutely appalled. They would just think this was such an abuse and neglect of children to expose them to this. Whereas the people in that village would have just shrugged their shoulders and said, well, how are they going to learn? How are they going to learn how to do these skills if they don't get to go, you know, learn them directly through hands-on experience? So that's just one. I can give more anecdotes like that, but that kind of is characteristic, I'd say.
You know, this reminds me of Vivian Zelizer's work. She's a professor of sociology, I think.
Yes.
And so she takes, what is that, economically price useless and socially priceless?
Yeah.
Right. So the child became that, and that's when the Western culture pivoted, that it became so precious that children could not touch anything because it would only cause harm and no learning. So can you maybe from your perspective, when did this shift happen? Or maybe start off with like weird societies, the acronym WEIRD. And how do we come to harbor these beliefs that children are precious, they need protection, they need freedom of certain things like what clothes you wear, but not really freedom to explore the world to determine what is safe or not? When did this shift happen, you think?
Well, I'll come to that in a minute, but you asked me several things, one of which was to explain for the audience what WEIRD is, what that's all about. So it's an acronym, Western Educated, Industrialized, Rich Democracies, WEIRD Societies. And this is a highly cited article by Joseph Henrich and two other colleagues, published in 2010. And the subtitle or the title is The Weirdest People in the World. And they did a very clever study of by looking at hundreds and hundreds of published articles on human psychology, basically, on trying to all the studies probing certain specific topics within that, but basically, they came to the conclusion that the subjects of those studies the authors of those studies, the countries of origin of the research, were all from this tiny little fragment of the world's population, which they characterized as Western, educated, so on and so on and so on.
Hmm.
And they found that that research was extremely limited in just being about that population. But furthermore, they particularly paid attention to any research that was comparative. So where there was comparative data available, so that you had some other cultures represented in the study, the weird population, mostly predominantly European, American, they were outliers. They were very poorly representative. So basically they called into question the entire canon of psychology. And I'm not just child psychology, but of psychology generally. And called it into question. And of course, this is something that anthropologists have known all along and didn't come as much of a surprise. But so that was the first thing that now help me go back.
Which is kind of, I think it is kind of 12% of the world's population, which is being studied. Considered the golden standard for the whole universe.
Exactly.
Yeah. So my second part of that question was, now that we, since we have this idea.
When did this start? Okay. I think a critical turning point was the decline in the birth rate internationally. Think about that. I mean, that was pretty dramatic, and that occurred in the period after, particularly after World War II, so 1940s, 1950s. There was a baby boom immediately after.
Yes.
But the next boom or next phase shortly after that generation, after the baby boomers were born, so to speak, the population dropped precipitously around the globe in the Western world, and to the point where several countries now, like Italy, are no longer in equilibrium. That is, they're losing the native population, or the native population is declining because of the very, very low birth rate. So when you have only one child or two instead of five and six, I think there's just immediately a greater anxiety. For one thing, the parenting labor that you may have spread over six children is now just focused on one or two. And then the anxiety is such that's, I think, quite normal and natural that you would have some anxiety about your children and their safety and well-being. It's going to be very different, very proportionally very different if you've only got one or two children as opposed to six or seven. I mean, the British and the... in the medieval period, used to have a saying about the succession, about successful marriage for the king, was that the wife would produce an heir and a spare, at least.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So people could be very, in effect, explicit and ruthless about having large families. And not worrying too much about any one member, any one child, because there were others to step up. And indeed, high infant mortality also contributed to people being perhaps a little callous, a little unconcerned about the loss of one or two children. So I think the decline in the birth rate that occurred throughout the 20th century, but particularly after the middle of the century, is a big contributing factor. And I think another is the children become projects. So I can't put my finger on where that starts and how that evolves. But that is one thing that strikes me as so strikingly different, is this shaping of children, trying to optimize them, think about extracurricular activities, think about all the medical interventions, orthodonture work. I mean, we spend so much money on perfecting our children. And so I think another thing is that in our very competitive society, weird society is competitive. There's not much cooperation. I mean, in the indigenous community, small face-to-face communities, people have to be interdependent. They have to help each other out. Whereas in our wealthy society, people can be much more independent. There are much less need for them to cultivate their neighbors and the community at large. And so they can devote more and more attention and lavish more and more resources on their children and then bask in the reflected glory.
You know, you remind me another psychologist I had on my podcast. She actually studies children from affluent societies and delinquent behaviors. Mm. And not societies, but affluent groups, you know, and her research project, Sonia Luther is her work, who has been a guest. And she actually talked about that she was studying children in low socioeconomic area around Yale. And just for comparison, she decided to select population from the affluent communities, children, and they were performing worse.
Really?
They were demonstrating more inappropriate behaviors than even lower socioeconomic groups of children from those groups. And that is also very much telling that, you know, this, I think you put your finger, it just unlocked this thought for me that indigenous is almost thought as underdeveloped and, somehow unsophisticated, but you just said it is actually a beautiful way to describe a small face-to-face societies. And you're right. Yeah, if there's a weird society, then there's no accountability and you don't have to cooperate. Everybody's for themselves.
Exactly. Well, I'm just, in fact, just working on this book that you mentioned. I'm just working on a section now, section of chapter 2, as a matter of fact, on the tendency to really emphasize with children. I've said children had a great deal of freedom. Indigenous children have a lot of freedom, and can take a lot of initiative. But there are certain times when parents think it necessary to intervene. One of those that shows up in many societies is an intervention to teach children kinship terminology and sharing behavior, generosity, and cooperation.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? That sounds tremendous.
Well, as I said, teaching is very, very rare. Lessons are very, very rare. Child learns on its own. But one of the places, which surprised me at first when I started to run across this, particularly throughout the Pacific region, cultures in the Pacific region, there's a tremendous emphasis on getting kids up to speed quickly in terms of their social standing, making them familiar with their extended family and community members, how to address them, what their names are, how they're supposed to be referred to, how different speech registers to be used in different circumstances. And excuse me, then also there's sometimes very explicit instruction, very game-like with babies, with very young children. They start in very early on grooming them to be socially acceptable, to fit in.
Wow.
That is a major contrast with weird population. And again, like so many other aspects of this, we can tentatively date a shift that occurred probably in the 50s and 60s, and that is that in the 60s and 70s in the United States, if you were middle class, you, well, every class, including working class, poverty class, it was extremely important to raise your children right, to bring them up to be polite, to be deferential, to be helpful, to be generous. All of these qualities we really emphasized in the United States, Europe, and so forth, even more so in the Far East, Japan, China. These characteristics, these attributes are even more important and more stressed is laid on them. And excuse me, this is tied in with, to a degree, with the birth rate, because one of the reasons for all this socializing of the child to kind of polish them up and make them socially acceptable instead of
polish
being
them up, yeah.
rotten brats, but instead of spoiling them and turning them into little monsters, Dennis the Menaces, if we wanted help from the community or from extended family looking after these children. So a mother's got a toddler and she's pregnant with the next child. There will be times when she can't cope with it, the situation entirely on her own. She'll need help. Babysitter, someone, grandma, an older sister, a relative, a neighbor. She wants them to, she'll ask them, and it's assumed that they're to volunteer to take over this child, look after it while the new baby makes primary demands on the mother's attention. Well, if that child is a hellion, you're going to have a hard time finding anybody willing to look after it. So it's just in the mother's, historically and cross-culturally, it's been in the mother's deepest
interest
to have her child be known by the community and accepted and be loved by the community. And that only happens when the child behaves in a way that invites attention and care.
You know, so that, again, that cultural regulation to yield cooperation, all these, you know, there's another neuroscientist, DiStenno, who talks about these higher emotions as a way to exercise self-regulation, which is gratitude, pride in your work, not arrogance, but pride, taking ownership of your work. And then the third is, of course, that, collaboration and cooperation. So, as you mentioned this, I was just thinking about, you have written a lot about this, idea of self-initiated learners. Mm-hmm. And, can you maybe define that a little bit? And in the context of learning, the idea of vicarious learning, learning by observing other people when you're not specifically directly taught. I feel like at least in America, there's no opportunity to observe other people to learn, because a lot of learning is very bookish, or it's not experiential learning. It is learning by somebody, blah, blah, even like, you know, talking about learning and then you inculcate that. So it's a transmission of information versus transmission of knowledge of how to. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of our podcast here, that there's this distinction, really dramatic distinction, between self-initiated learning and the, you might say, the other
imposed
adult-initiated learning. And it's a huge gulf now. I mean, it's a really, really significant divide in the social landscape. And one of the places where, if you want to get a conversation going about this, drop into a faculty lounge somewhere and ask your fellow colleagues on the university faculty about this issue. And even though I'm retired, I still hang out with those who aren't retired and are still teaching. And this was a phenomenon that I had noticed over the course of my career, but it's really reached kind of crisis proportion now, which is that we have college students who are incredibly needy and and unable and unwilling to take risks. And so they become virtually parasites, kind of camping out on the professor's tour, so to speak, in order to get detailed and careful guidance. And there's so much fear of failure. There's so much dependence on somebody else telling them what to do and how to do it that psychologists have a term called phrase. I'm sure you're familiar with learned helplessness.
Learned helplessness.
I would argue that children are from birth. They are self-initiated learners. The child is programmed not to be sit at a desk and listen to a teacher at the blackboard. That's not the way our species evolved. Our species evolved to produce children who are incredibly curious, who are great spectators. We think of children being hooked on media nowadays. Well, I watch children in villages, and man, if they weren't doing a chore, they would look for whatever was going on and just they would sit watching what others were doing, even when I thought this is pretty boring. But from their point of view, it was the best show in town or in the village. So they are taking the initiative to discover and absorb all this new information like sponges. And they're great imitators from birth. And yet we squelch all that. We suffocate it. We snuff it out. And we program our children's daily lives from start to finish. And whether it's swimming lessons or piano lessons or times tables or reading or grammar, all of this is just, we just keep piling it on and piling it on and piling it on. And as a result, at the college level, we have what should be self-starting learners. One of the things that happens in college historically is that the amount of time that the teacher has to devote to individual students is much less than it is in high school. It just sort of drops off the map because we are supposed to be doing research and publishing and scholarship. So faculty are not supposed to invest as much in individual children and their needs and personality characteristics and emotional needs and so on. We're not supposed to do that because we have this other major job to do. And unfortunately, so many of our students now have not really been prepared for that. They, on the contrary, with each passing year of their schooling, they become more dependent on minute guidance to with every learning task we set for them.
You know, I think the two thoughts come to mind. I was at that cooking class yesterday, as I was mentioning, and a person sitting next to me, she has been, in her job for 25 years, and she's at a very big firm, and she was talking about the new generation of employees that come up. You know, they have a lot of education. And they come, and she was saying the same thing what you said. Mm. So first of all, she says the OJT, on the job training, they take very long. They don't pick up things through osmosis. They're not observant enough
because
to pick up the nuances.
Lost that it's been drummed out of them.
Yes,
very early on.
And they want specifics. Like, what do you want me to do? If you say, create a report. Oh, how many pages? What font? How much margin? You know, she's like, just do it. And then she was saying the second, the tail end of that evolution is, she said, within 10 months, they come and they're like, oh, when am I going to get promoted?
Right.
And she says, no, you're not a promotion material at all. And so I said, oh my God, their egos are so fragile that they get very offended. Yeah, right. And she said, I don't care. I tell them you can leave.
Well, good for her. She's in a minority.
She's an anomaly.
She needs to be on her guard because a lawsuit might very well be in hanging over her head.
Or like this, anonymous on social media, the spite that just spews, you're not able to handle that. So this brings us to a great junction here on talking about mental health. You're writing about this. There's a huge mental health crisis, two kinds. One is incredible anxiety, which you already kind of talked about, that if a lot is expected of you and you're supposed to demonstrate everything, then you become very anxious that maybe you're not good enough and maybe you're truly not good enough. That's a separate issue. But the second thing is depression, like not having purpose and meaning, which is so much tied with autonomy. When you don't have authorship of your life, then, I feel like, how can that bring joy? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I tend to always start with the youngest children, babies, toddlers, because in talking about parenting styles or parenting practices or culture and parenting, a lot of times problems that we see with teenagers, with college students, have their origin in what happened to them when they were toddlers. And we talked already, we touched all the bases. We've talked about overprotection. We've talked about parents turning everything in the child's life into a learning opportunity, which translates as a teaching because they can't really do much on their own, translates as an opportunity to give a lesson to the child. And I think it starts this kind of learned helplessness, this loss of the children have very good, they're very good observers. They're genetically, I mean, from it's an inherited
species
characteristic, the ability to learn from observation and imitate what one has learned is very strong. But these are underutilized skills. These are skills that eventually extinguish because they're unappreciated. The child is, there's so many areas of the home that are off limits. So many in the neighborhood, we talked about that a little bit earlier, the restrictions. When you gave the example of the screened in backyard, I had this sudden image of the prison.
Yes.
In a prison where the prisoners get out for an hour or something and walk around the fenced in area. It's like we imprison our children. So I think the seeds are planted very, very early. So your friends, employees, would-be employees, all of that baggage they bring with them is accumulates year after year after year, and it's the trends are not good. It's getting worse. And I sent you that paper that is now we're working on with colleagues, but we're trying to show how there is a relationship between how children are reared, this overprotection, overconcern, overmanagement of their lives. This leads to the psychological disorders, depression, mental health issues that are becoming more and more. I mean, the statistics are staggering. And it starts very early. I mean, don't ask me to quote the figures, but the number of children, for instance, taking psychotropic drugs, number of very young children, like 6, 7 years old on drugs for emotional disturbance. It's just frightening. It's scary. You have things like autism, for example, which exploded, came out of nowhere. I did research on autism in about 1980 with colleagues at UCLA. And at that time, they were keeping a register of autistic children, national register, and there were only, we were talking maybe in the few thousands altogether. nowadays, I don't know what the statistics are on prevalence of autism, but it's skyrocketed. And so, I mean, I think there is a clear, very clear relationship between how we're raising children and the eventual likelihood of failure to launch, and insecurity, anxiety, lack of executive function. I mean, failure, yes. Breakdown in executive function. You know, they're all part of the same story as far as I can see.
You know, it's so funny that, I mean, it's, sorry, not funny, ironic, that I see such a trend to, from a culture which was completely unaware of inner lives of children, inner psychological lives of children, then suddenly they're seeing this incredible implosion.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's awareness that there's crisis, mm-hmm. but there's, it's now again, the same attitude, let's fix it. Mm-hmm. There's no like contextualizing back to the culture, back to the society. Like, you know, I was telling one of my clients that the child is not even getting up from bed to go to school. Mm-hmm. And so she now had so invested parent that she now is driving the child to the psychiatrist, psychologist, me. But who is waking the child up is her. Who is getting the child into the car? Her. Mm-hmm. She's actually packing, because he's not getting up in time, she's packing lunch for him mm-hmm. and putting shoes in the car. Mm-hmm. All he's doing is just being transported. And so I said to her, would you consider taking a break? Like completely like taking a year off, and then he maybe learns some work, like wilderness, go maybe, you know, like chop wood or something, you know, they're like not those special things.
Right.
But I think this fear about this something about this invisible competition you have for resources, mm-hmm. this feeling that somehow education and career and college readiness is the ultimate golden truth of becoming lead a meaningful life, to me is a kind of a hoax that we have created for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I'm already going to sound like an aberrant person as I say that, but I truly think there's so much, like we are looking at treatment also as something that is done outside the culture, which the culture doesn't value having mental health problem because it doesn't think becoming cooperative human as a valuable thing, you know?
Well, it could.
So
it, it so easily backfire because basically, what's going on here is the child develops all of these problems, these emotional, mental health issues, and they often get translated into a narrative that explains the child's failure to thrive, failure to launch, and essentially they define themselves as someone who is permanently handicapped and will require concessions of various kinds. They expect to be given a pass where others might have to strive and so on. They're given a pass. And in many ways, we've been very generous and our laws have been changed and treatments have been changed so that we're all enabling. I mean, all of our agencies, all of our various branches of government and social services, we're all enabling this learned helplessness and giving it sounding labels and providing all sorts of clinically sounding excuses. I'm sounding pretty jaded and like an old bogey here, but honestly, it just...
I hear you. I understand what you're saying.
We're not honest with ourselves and acknowledge that this is what is going on. It's just going to keep getting worse.
So as I know, this is not the realm of practice for an anthropologist. would you comment...
lot of this I'm speaking as a father of two daughters and the grandfather of a 3.5-year-old granddaughter. And I pay a lot of attention to
children
and granddaughter.
And that's why I'm going to extend this question as our last question, that how can we change? Because cultures and societies don't change by one person. It has to be a cultivated common belief and our commitment to act in that way as collectively. So how can weird societies stop being weird?
Well,
or that's not a good question to ask.
I mean, I think we need to rely upon our opinion leaders and people that are in key positions. So that paper I was speaking to you about is actually hopefully going into a journal addressed to pediatricians. So what do I know about pediatrics? Very little. But what I do, the stuff that I do know about, I'm arguing should be part of the awareness of pediatricians, yes, so that they can turn around and provide more sensible long-term guidance to parents, teachers. I think we need to get our teachers' associations and our college-level teacher preparation programs to basically to engage in a conversation about this and to pay attention to the anthropological literature and other sources, historical materials. In other words, to basically look more broadly at this and don't simply go along with this trend of children becoming more and more handicapped, more and more needs, have special needs. I mean, it ends up you have a whole classroom and they all have special needs of one sort.
Yes. And, we just had a meeting with a district leader. Yeah. Who was talking about the same thing. She said, there used to be like a small group of people who had disability. Now the whole class has.
Right.
So as I end, you know, that a wonderful book, it was written in 2001, believe it or not, when my, I was just beginning my parenting journey, and that was called, it was written by a psychotherapist actually called Blessings of a Skinned Knee. And it's
I think I would like this book.
You will love it because it actually talks about this, you know, raising self-reliant children, but kind of encouraging children to have scrapes and let them fall and let them pick themselves up and then consider that as a blessing, you know, bow to the experience.
Right. My philosophy entirely.
And a brilliant timing. I think your daughter may love this. I think this may be your gift for her during Christmas.
Thank you. I will, that's a good tip.
I wrap this conversation, brilliant conversation up, we always ask our esteemed guests to recommend a book or two that, other than your prolific writing, do you have anything that has influenced your worldview and your beliefs about how to do the work that you do or anything in life?
Well, I wasn't expecting this question, so I don't have a ready answer. But the person that immediately came to mind when you posed the question was Margaret Mead.
Yes, and Margaret Mead.
She's sort of the mother of, she's really a founding mother of the whole field of anthropology, but especially the anthropology of childhood. And I had her in college. Didn't get along with her and didn't like the class at all. But subsequently, fortunately, I read her work and I'm just in awe of her insights. And so she's writing as an American, about it, visiting many other cultures, and she's seeing these discrepancies between the indigenous model of child rearing and the Western model, and her work has lots of insights I think that would be of interest.
That's, you know, wonderful.
I think if parents are interested in understanding more, not just about their own child, but about children and childhood, I think that would, you know, that would be one way to get at this trend maybe slowing down or reducing the trends that we're seeing, the unpleasant trends.
And, you know, like all the things that we want in our children, my biggest question is, parents, are you demonstrating it? You know, like this, we want kids to be curious.
Right.
We want kids to have freedom. Are you exercising your freedom, you know,
right.
to explore the world, you know, show curiosity and be all always ready to say, yeah, yes, and, you know, so.
Oh thank you. I thought of a book. I thought.
Yes, which one?
You know, we discussed it. Free Range Children.
Yes.
Lenore Skenazy.
Brilliant.
That sums up a lot of our conversation today. Free range children.
I will attach that is a wonderful, and I think you're collaborating with the author, right? Or your friends.
Yes, right. I'd say we're friends. We're very, very good friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. So, all right, everyone, that's all the time we have for today. Once again, thank you, Dr. Lancy, for being my guest. Everybody, as you can see, these are very important conversations. I really hope you might wonder, this is our second anthropologist on this show. I really think one of the biggest things we can do in understanding executive function and our role in either managing our own thoughts, actions, behaviors, in relationship to achieving goals that are important to us and helping children to do the same, we must really have a cultural perspective and a real lens on life that our worldview may not be adequate. And I think, thank you for the work you do. And once again, we are so grateful for your time for being here. And until next time, see you soon.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.